This morning, as I'm leaving today, a little later in the morning, as Christopher mentioned, I feel very sad to leave, especially after feeling so at home with all of you and the situation we're in here. But the reality is, I have to make a home everywhere. So I'm moving on. But I thought I'd use this morning and divide it into three parts. Firstly, to talk a little bit personally about some personal issues in relation to the Dharma, the way of life that we're learning here. And then to talk a little bit about instruction with a certain perspective, and then to have some silence. So we'll divide it into these three parts. And what I'd like to talk about that touches me quite deeply is this statement that meditation is not about experiences, but it's about attitude. And it's something which is for inside the retreat and outside the retreat. When we mean attitude, when I say attitude, I really mean the slow shift that may happen in our lives, whether it's in one day or it's in 10 years, a slow shift of the way we look at things, the way we look at the events that happen to us. Attitude basically means the first noble truth. The first of the eight noble truths, which is the map or the journey, the spiritual journey as defined by the Buddha. And the first of the truths is right view, right understanding, right attitude. And this attitude is one of a gradual shift from the me position to the life position, so that we don't sense that, like, I am the king of my kingdom and everything is happening to me. And everything is for me, and life is for me, and I choose this and I choose that, and it's critical that I choose the right thing for me, and so on and so on. And when death comes, it's an utter disaster, because the for me stops completely. So gradually and easily shifting out of that for me position to the for life position, and that's a shift in view. And to me, that is what we're doing here, and that's what's propelled me all these years to keep practicing, to keep going deeper into the teachings. It's touched me in a number of ways, and I'll just pick out one or two ways in which this has touched me in my own life. One of the ways in which it's touched me is in the life perspective being an essentially ecological perspective, in the deepest possible sense. If we can feel the sense of being with all life, slowly dropping our, like I say, the king, the ruler of our self, and just become participant, this is essentially ecological way of life. It leads automatically to a holistic or an ecological way of living, without strain or without principles, without concepts, without having to read 200 books on what ecology is all about. It's just a natural sense of connectedness. I experienced it in my own life because I have a farm, and I built my own house, and I've been farming or working in the land for 20 years since I came to Israel. And there was, right at the beginning, in the beginning of the 80s, I had a really hard time. And the hard time was called Sikul, picking stones. For 2 years, I picked stones by hand out of the earth. And in these 2 years, I gradually became confused in a way. Who am I really? If I'm picking stones, then I'm a stone picker, because I'm doing it every day, and that's, and then the rest of me, which includes, you know, university and being a lecturer and being academic and all that, is a pure imagination. Where is it? When I pick this stone, where is the rest of me? It's a memory, but a memory is just like this. It can be, it's nothing. So the continuity of daily life for 2 years, picking stones and handling stones and building stones. I was building my own house, and the thing about working with stones is that you really think you've become a stone. As I built and handled stones every single day, they became part of my dreams. At night I would imagine stones. In the day I would keep looking at stones, which is nicer, which is not nicer, which is heavy, which is not heavy, what's the texture, what's the, and on and on. It's a really heavy conditioning process. And I was dreaming stones, thinking stones, feeling stones, being stone, being stoned by stones. And by the way, I remember the story of Milarepa, who's a great Tibetan sage. For 35 years, he was told by his teacher Naropa, go and build with stones. And during this 35 years, his teacher Naropa never gave him one little bit of Dharma. And he was begging every time he built something. And Naropa would come, and he always made him build at the top of hills. So he had to carry all the stones up to the top of a hill, build a house. It took him 7 years, and then Naropa would say, okay, I changed my mind. Take them down and put them up on the other hill over there. This went on 35 years. And think what it does to the self-importance. Think what it does to the self-importance. The me position. It's just shattering. We have it really easy here. We can work on the me position by just being quietly, getting fed, getting looked after, having people kind of mother us here, and we work on the me position. But sometimes it's really hard. And anyway, that went with the early days of my practice. So this was a very powerful experience for me in life, practicing and then being a stone and losing bits of myself. And at the time, it was quite painful to lose bits of myself. What, for example, I kept thinking, what did I do all this academic work for? Why did I sit 20 years writing essays, writing this, going to exams? If I'm, you know, it was really painful. And but a very deep lesson that's been with me, as it's as important to me in my life as any retreat that I've ever done. So this sense of ecological vision, replacing the self-importance, which is not anyone's fault, it's itself life, karma, you can give any number of words to it. It is life that made us so self-important. We can't blame anything or blame anyone. So from that place of self-importance, we just need to kind of slowly let it go back into life, you know, just be less self-concerned bit by bit. Recently I had my car stolen, and the car went, no car, okay. And I kept thinking, well, I'm very inconvenienced by my car being stolen, and I don't feel very good about this, But how would I feel if it was the next person's car being stolen? I mean, I'm concerned about my car being stolen, but why am I not as concerned about the next guy's? If I see my friends, my neighbors, or a stranger that I don't know, and his car is stolen, it's automatic that we position turns up all the time. And over the years, and through practice, and also through this kind of ecological life, to a large extent, I'm trying to work on that me position, that I position. Can be a we position, of course, can be my people, my country, my group, can be my sangha, my dharma group, very precious, and not liking it to change or to be distorted or moved or lost or whatever. The me and the us position. One of the things that grows with the dropping of the me position is a certain sensitivity to the small things. And it's quite interesting, in my vegetable garden, if people come and want to help in the vegetable garden, two kinds of people. One would say, I know what to do. I want to go and look after the cabbages. I see these nice big cabbages. And as they run to the cabbages, they step on all the little plants that are on the way that don't look very interesting. They don't look like you could eat them. They're rather small, and they're sometimes rather full of weeds. So it's anyway quite difficult to know what's a weed and what's a small parsley, petrosilia. It's not so easy. So there is another approach, which is treading very, very carefully, saying, I don't know what's going on here. This is a new territory. I see nice juicy cabbages over there, but I want to watch where my feet are, right here. That to me is the ecological vision. Where do you put your feet? When you take a step, where do you put your feet? And it goes with being aware of small things, goes with being compassionate with small things. That nothing is unimportant. Everything is important. This is essentially the ecological vision. Everything is important. You cannot ignore anything. Day before yesterday, Saturday, we had a meeting about the activities of the Sangha. And it was a planning meeting. And there was Christopher and a few other people who were doing work organizing activities. And for a while, Christopher was quite quiet. And we were busy talking. And then out of the corner of my eye, I noticed what he was doing. He was picking flies out of his cup of tea and throwing them in the air, letting them free. As we've been talking, the flies had fallen into his cup of tea, and he was sort of busily taking them out and freeing them. And here is your ecological vision in practice, more than any words, more than any talks, more than any obvious teachings or readings in books. This is the compassion from seeing life not just through the lens of your me position, of me and my interests, and what mazebali akshav, or lo magiali akshav, I deserve something, magiali, etc., etc. And part of this story is being able to be with things that are not really known. And being able to be with the undefined, things not really defined for you, not really clear. A lot of people have asked in the small groups, how do I make choices? How do I choose? I'm coming to a crossroads. How do I choose a job or a partner or a journey or a direction? Or how do I choose in practice? Do I work with my breath, or do I work with my painful feelings, or how do I choose? And a lot of this, as I say, dropping the me position automatically creates a sense of respect for the unknown, because it's the me that thinks it knows. As soon as you begin to drop the knowing self, somehow you become to touch the things you don't know, and they are right. Dropping the me position is also being comfortable with things you don't really know, with things you cannot actually choose in a rational way. Anyway, we can't really choose in a rational way, because every time we face choices, we're facing the unknown, and the mind is spinning like crazily, trying to work out all possible futures, like the vast computer, thinking it can plot and calculate every possible future and take the best one, the best for the me. The trouble is, it's the best for the me now, and we forget that the me is going to be different in 5 minutes or 10 meters down the road is another me. Things have changed, so again we have to do it all over again. So anyway, it's impossible, and all we can do is kind of throw out choices into the future. But this being with the unknown and being comfortable, a little bit more comfortable, as we drop bits of ourself, we can become a little more comfortable with things that are out there that we don't know, or that we can feel, or that we can somehow sense. And that creates a lot of relief. It can be at the beginning difficult. It's like you have to drop some baggage, to drop some stuff. Drop the things that you think you rely on. Like, I know me, and my way is like that. But when you drop that, even a little bit, what takes its place is some kind of ease with the unknown, a little bit more ease with the unexpected. And from that ease with the unexpected, choices can come more easily. And this is something I found in my own life. I don't feel so compelled to be a certain type of person and say, well, I must be like this. I'm the academic, I have to do an academic job, I have to do this and I have to go that and that because society says it. Sense of playfulness or originality can play like this and can play like that. Can be with stones, can be with something else. This playfulness comes from not taking your choices too seriously, being lighter. And the lightness is to do with unknown. Let it come. It's unknown anyway. Anyway, we don't really know. So let it come. Let it show itself. And that sense lightens the choices we have to make. Sense of the unknown, sense of the mystery. And the growing trust in this unknown. It's like the trust grows from sitting down in a certain place in the stillness that we've been doing and just being with the changes. Trust grows even if we may not notice it. And that's my own personal experience. Things grow even if we don't notice them. They do grow in us. The sitting, for example, absolutely quiet with nothing happening. Nothing much is happening. But sitting with the nothing much happening creates trust in the nothing. Because I'm here, and I'm all right, and there's nothing. Well, so what happened? It's a big disaster. No, nothing much happened, but I'm here, I'm okay. And I'm here, and life is here, and I'm with life. So this growing trust, which we can practice in the meditation hall, without knowing that we're practicing it too specifically, and without identifying it exactly, a sense of, yeah, nothing much is happening and I'm fine with that. So that builds, I think, a sense of trust in unknown, in things that we ourselves don't have an interest in. It's just life. So that's just some reflections. I think I'll stop at this point. Some reflections on what's been important to me in my own Dharma life in the last years. And now I'd like to address one or two practice issues here. And I'd like to do it very briefly in the form of what's called the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, which is not something to worry about at all, but it's just a certain model of the human being which is in the Buddhist psychology or in the Buddhist understanding of reality. And what the Four Foundations are basically: the life of the body, which includes the senses and the touch of life, the bodily life includes the breath and so on, the feelings, the way we respond to this life, our reaction, we like it, we don't like it, our sense of relating or responding, evaluating, valuing, desiring, and so on. Emotions, emotional life, anger and so on, that hold us, they're more long-term issues in us. And thought or mental content, which includes all the things that arise in the mind. Through the habits of mind, any content, thoughts, dreams, pictures, visions, music, words, noises, anything, any mental content. So that's basically the way the view of areas where we can concentrate on. Now, it's in this retreat we are concentrating mostly, almost entirely, in our focus on the first foundation, on the body and the bodily life, because there is an unparalleled importance in that. There is no question that there is our fundamental work. If we can stay with this is the spine, the Amud Chidra of our practice. This is the spine of our practice. This is the place of home. Our attention in the body is our fundamental place, our anchor from which all other things can grow. And it's because it's there and it's touchable and it's tangible and it's also subtle and delicate. And in a way, we don't need to go any further than that. In the suttas, they say very clearly, you can be enlightened from just practice with the breath only. So it's our main direction here, and we've been discussing the main themes of attention to the breath, steadiness, qualities, how it changes, how we relate to it, the breath and the body. And sometimes we may feel we're not going deep enough, it's just body and it's just breath and it's a little bit boring and so on. The depth comes through continuousness, continuation, as much as we can be closer and closer and closer and longer and longer and longer with the breath, for example, things begin to happen. Things begin to take more, there are more events inside. We become more sensitive. Things happen. Depth is defined really as continuousness, not diving in, down somewhere, but actually keeping going. And we find that things change in this horizontal way. So we talked about ways of being with the breath, the sense of energy and wakefulness, the sense of peace at the same time, or calm, the sense of appreciation, caring for the breath, the sense of investigation and sharpness of attention, being clear, the breath coming, going, the beginning, the middle, the end, so on, sharpening all the time, going a little bit more careful, the microscope. We also talked a little bit about experimenting, playing with it. There are a lot of parameters. We can try this and we can try that. We can try more depth or more breath. We can try penetrating in a small part of the breath or feeling the whole breath and so on. So what I'm trying to say here is that there's a lot of play in this. There's a lot of parameters. It's a very rich field, just the breath and the body. One thing that I don't think we had the instruction yet about sound. We did in the first 5 days. But there's another dimension that you could just be aware of, which is to practice with going out, to practice openness. And one of the great tools of practicing openness, occasionally, if it feels right for you, if you feel contracted or you feel too tense and focused inward, you can try going out more. And one of the ways to do that is practicing with sound. You can do that especially at the beginning of the practice. Sound meaning all the sound that touches you without choosing any of them. As they arrive, so they are. Don't choose, you don't interpret. You don't need to say, that's the air conditioner, and then of course, I like it, I don't like it, it means this, it means that, it's good, it's bad, it's this. Just sound. It's like white noise, the air conditioner, a voice, a wheelbarrow outside, a car over there. It's just sound. So a sense of openness, a sense of receptivity to sound without choosing can be can give us feeling or a taste of this non-choosing, choiceless, open awareness. And that can sometimes be a great... it can really change something in our practice if we sometimes just touch that sense of openness. So feelings and reactions and responses, we also mentioned this, and this is the next part of the foundations. We like, we don't like, things that are arising for us. I have a pain, I'm pushing it away. I'm rejecting, reacting, pushing away. Or going towards, I had a nice sitting, I want another one. It was very peaceful for me, I want another one of those. Going towards, leaning into, desiring for results, desiring for change. I want a certain experience, for example. It's very common. We all of us must be going through this, more or less. Wanting. Wanting lunch. Wanting. The leaning into it. These kind of reactions and responses, it's a whole world, we can go into that too. And the main issue about that, or one issue about that, is only to try and notice them. Sometimes they are very quick and they are very subtle. And so if we feel very quiet, it's easier to notice how we're reacting to things inside us. Pulling them, wanting, rejecting, etc., etc. The two other areas of emotional life and thinking life are basically the emotional life. You've been getting some instructions, not so much in this practice session, but in the small groups, in the talks. And it's a general issue. Firstly, and I only want to mention two or three key points about emotional life. Firstly, it's wise not to look for it, not to hunt for emotions. If they're there, if something comes up, it comes up by itself. Allow it to come by itself. If it comes, don't get too much into the story of it. If you feel anger, if you feel anxiety, which is fear or any other kind of feeling in the range called fear, anxieties, worries, concerns, etc., etc. It's another group. Love, another group. All the different range of colors of emotions. the way to be with them is, as I say, let them, if they come up during practice, you just it's a sense like holding them for a while, holding them with care, holding them with a sense of not judging you for having these feelings, just holding them in your attention, knowing as clearly as possible what this feeling is. If you can, sometimes it's, if it's a strong feeling and it's taking you over, it might even be possible to give it a name in your mind. Ah, fear. Actually give it a label, because this helps the process of knowing it. If you know it, it's part of the way of being with it, just knowing it. If it's very strong, it might just suck you in, and you're in it and in it and in it, and usually it happens anyway for a while. But this sense of, okay, here it is again, knowing it coming up, is really the main or the key issue with emotional life. As it comes up, know it's coming up, as it, knowing all the things that are happening with it, what's it doing in the body. If the fear is arising again, where do I feel it here? Where is it going? What's it doing? Just being with it, sort of like Thich Nhat Hanh says, holding the crying baby. It's yours, it's a crying baby, you don't throw it out, but you don't also want to keep it crying. You want to somehow, by holding it, just being with it, feeling its cry, and then the crying will stop. And then you naturally let it go, and you go back to your breath, you go back to your basic practice, your anchor in the breath and body. And so you'll learn more in the small. It comes out more in the small groups. You'll be talking more. We have been talking about dealing with emotions, being with emotions, being close to emotions. Just somehow to remember that our emotional life comes as a result of causes and conditions, just like everything else. So it's not our fault. Me doesn't need to judge itself. It's not the fault of anything or anyone. It is the universe, it is the life itself being angry. So anger is coming out, anger is a property of the universe, property of life. So anger, here it is. Hold the crying baby. And the final element of the four foundations of mindfulness, thought and thinking, mental content, we probably won't go into that in this retreat. We don't need to. It's not an issue that we need to work on. But it's just, again, to be aware that if mental content is going to be there all the time, we're not trying to stop it, we're not trying to close the tap, we're not trying to stop the energy of the mind. There will be mental content, and then breath and body and so on, and then thoughts will come, and breath and body. And as much as we cannot, all we in a sense need to do is not give it food, just simply not give it nutrition, not be into it for long periods of time, just keep dropping out as soon as we notice that we are thinking, that there's mental content, dropping out of it back to our breath and body. And that's all that we need to think about at this stage, and maybe there'll be some more instructions about this later on. So that's all I want to say at this point, and perhaps then we can have some silence for the rest of this session. And I wish you all goodbye, and I hope, really I hope, that I have a chance to meet and be with you all at other times and other retreats. And one final point is that if anyone wants to have a meeting after a period of time, and we realize there is a need for support or questions as you kind of hit the daily life and all the shock waves that comes out of that and the issues coming out of that, so that in about a month or so it'll be possible for us to meet, and you'll be hearing more about that at the end of the retreat. So if anyone wants to sort of sit with me